sixth administration, actually.
The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry, however, has warned against any possible act of adventurism against country's interests, pledging an immediate, powerful, and serious response to any such move. A source close to Iran's Supreme National Security Council said that threats issued by Western officials and Israel are considered more of a propaganda gesture. The source, however, vowed any move against Iran's interests and national security will be met with Tehran's, quote, crushing and firm response, and Washington and London will be directly responsible for the consequences. There are also unconfirmed reports that Israel has gotten the green light from the U.S. to go ahead with an attack that may involve targeting an Iranian port or vessel.
It is time of transition of power in Iran, but the Westerners think that this time of transition is affecting the military power and will of Iran. But the military and the armed forces are not under the president in Iran. And so that by the change of the administration, the policies or the actually vigilance of the armed forces would change.
If the report is true, it goes to show that London and Washington have given Israel carte blanche to commit crimes with impunity. But as Iranian officials have stressed, any possible aggression won't go unanswered.
More than 15 million American renters are at risk of eviction without backup as a ban on residential evictions expired on Saturday at midnight. Early Sunday, some Democratic lawmakers rallied outside the Capitol to call for the ban's reinstatement. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention ordered the moratorium to fight the spread of the COVID-19 and prevent homelessness during the pandemic. It came into effect in September 2020 and has been extended multiple times. The U.S. Congress had approved around $47 billion in rental relief to states during the pandemic, but the money has been slow to make it into the hands of those in need. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said only $3 billion out of the total allocated fund has been distributed to renters. Pelosi and other top Democrats have urged the administration of Joe Biden to extend the moratorium through October the 18th. The U.S. President Joe Biden is under fire by his own party members. The Democrats criticized Biden's inaction as the deadline neared, some furious that he called on Congress to provide a last-minute solution to protect renters. Biden had asked Congress to extend the deadline on Thursday amid the surging Delta variant, but Congress failed to act after Republican House members blocked a Democratic-led bid. The House has already left for a six-week summer recess, and it remains unclear whether the administration could extend the moratorium using executive powers.
It's a partisan issue. There's absolutely no difficulty with the United States providing the money to their own citizens to enable them to pay their rental commitments. And it's something I argued back in March of 2020, where it's absolutely necessary because if you're going to fight the virus, you have to enable people to stay at home. If they stay at home, they can't earn an income, so they must be given a cash flow to cover their outgoings, so you don't get people being made homeless courtesy of fighting a pandemic.
Pressure is mounting on U.S. lawmakers to extend a moratorium that barred landlords from evicting certain tenants who could not pay rent during the pandemic. This put millions of Americans at risk of being homeless amid the coronavirus pandemic. Meanwhile, top U.S. infectious disease expert Anthony Fauci has warned that the coronavirus situation in the United States is set to get worse as the country grapples with a surge in the Delta variant of the COVID-19. The U.S. is currently the worst hit nation by the pandemic. Homeless Americans could face other challenges as well. For instance, Los Angeles has approved a new law that makes it illegal for unhoused people to be in almost all places across the city. If you become homeless in LA, that's the fair fate that awaits you. That's why the latest city count shows LA has over 66,000 homeless people.
And it shows the extent to which the American political system uses its own people as a bargaining chip or a shuttlecock in this battle between the two ruling parties. So it's utterly unnecessary and will be very damaging And again, it's a sign of just how divided America is these days that this is being allowed to happen.
The expiration of the U.S. eviction ban could send millions of people out on the streets. Then they're faced with the threat of the coronavirus and hunger. Currently, around 40 million low-income Americans rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program to stay out of hunger. It seems the U.S. politicians are more interested in spending money on wars and U.S. military bases and adventures around the world instead of their own people.
Limelight. Following the global wave of demonstrations after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis last year, Republican state legislatures mounted a counterattack, introducing a deluge of anti-riot bills designed to make it easier for law enforcement to clamp down on demonstrations perceived as disorderly. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by John Skolnick, writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Police are backing bills that make it easier to crush nonviolent protests. Following the global wave of demonstrations after the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis last year, Republican state legislatures mounted a counterattack, introducing a deluge of anti-riot bills designed to make it easier for law enforcement to clamp down on demonstrations perceived as disorderly. According to a Pan America report from late April, Republicans have proposed at least 100 anti-riot bills in 33 states from last June to this March. These measures aim to address protest-related activities by greatly expanding the definition of riot, granting criminal immunity to drivers who hit rioters with their cars, suspending state benefits for those who participate in a riot, and increasing penalties for demonstrators who block traffic. Over the past several months, the bills have sparked progressive pushback over the perception that they grant the police unchecked power to crack down on nonviolent protests and chill free speech rights. Indeed, reports now make clear that police organizations and their allies have played an outsized role in introducing and supporting these measures, often by advocating and lobbying for them behind the scenes. According to new research related, U.S. police officers and law enforcement lobbies have supported one or more anti-riot bills in at least 14 states since last June. Anti-riot bills in 19 states have been sponsored by legislators with backgrounds in law enforcement. Because lobbying records are inconsistent from state to state, these figures may be underestimates. Almost nobody knows right now that police are pushing for these bills. Connor Gibson, an opposition researcher who compiled the data, told reporters in an interview. He added, "People are not surprised that police are lobbying for bills that let police off the hook and push the blame to protesters. But I don't think that should be the measure of why this trend is important." Consider HB 445 in Alabama, which broadens the definition of riot and heightens the legal penalties against protesters who block traffic. The bill, which has been indefinitely postponed, was sponsored by at least 9 state lawmakers who are or were affiliated with various police departments and organizations. The bill's primary sponsor, GOP Representative Alan Treadway, is a retired Birmingham assistant police chief. Two co-sponsors, Representatives Alan Farley and Philip Pites, respectively, served as police chief in Satosma Police Chief and Alabama State Trooper. In North Carolina, a similar bill is being considered that was sponsored by a total of 7 police-affiliated lawmakers. The bill's 2 primary sponsors, Representatives Charles Miller and Alan McNeil, respectively, served as deputy chief of the Brunswick County Sheriff's Office and chief deputy of Randolph County Sheriff's Office. Police culture is deeply embedded in our state legislatures, Gibson said, observing that many legislators have conflicts of interest when it comes to holding the police accountable. These bills are also heavily influenced by police organizations like Fraternal Order of Police and the Sheriff's Association, whose state chapters have lobbied for several different anti-riot bills throughout the U.S. since June. Consider Florida's HB 1, which became law in April. The comprehensive measure, which makes aggravated rioting a felony, denies bail to those charged of a misdemeanor during a protest and grants civil legal immunity to motorists who drive through demonstrators blocking a road. Was supported by the Florida Sheriff's Association, the Florida Police Chiefs Association, and Florida Smart Justice Alliance, a broad coalition of organizations focused on the state's criminal justice and correction system. Barney T. Bishop III, the CEO of Florida Smart Justice Alliance, explained his organization's stance in an interview with reporters, disputing the notion the HB 1 would embolden those on the far right to retaliate against social justice protesters. "It's not about emboldening anybody," he said. "Florida is as opposed to the Proud Boys and the far right groups as we are to the far right groups," unquote. His explanation of the bill's aims, however, suggests otherwise. Protesters today feel that they can go anywhere they want, do anything they want, beat some cars, cuss and try to incite violence from police by screaming in their face, Bishop added. "There are people that will incite violence. Most of the time, it will be the people in the protest themselves or the people behind the protest, like George Soros and Antifa and BLM. There is little evidence that last year's wave of social justice demonstrations after the Floyd murder was plagued by violence, according to a report last September by the Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project, ACLED. About 95% of all demonstrations from last May to last August were peaceful. By comparison, the report notes that authorities have used force, such as firing less lethal weapons like tear gas, rubber bullets, and pepper spray, or beating demonstrators with batons in over 54% of the demonstrations in which they have engaged. Benavides, director of PEN America's U.S. Free Expression Programs, affirmed ACLED's findings, telling reporters that the Republican-backed anti-riot bills are trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist. Legislators are predicting their bills on a circumstance that characterizes protests as somehow inherently criminal. As in the Florida case, a newly enacted anti-riot bill in Iowa, SF-342, was backed by various police-affiliated organizations, including the Iowa Peace Officers Association, the Iowa State Police Association, the Iowa Fraternal Order of Police, the Iowa State Patrol Supervisors Association, and the Iowa State Sheriffs and Deputies Association, according to state lobbying records. Interestingly, the Iowa Peace Officers Association and the Iowa State Sheriff and Deputy Association were initially undecided on the bill after it was introduced in February. At the time, the bill simply sought to prevent police officers from being discharged, disciplined, or threatened with discharge if their names appeared on the Brady list, which tracks officers who might lack credibility in certain legal cases involving the police. Since then, the bill has morphed into full-fledged anti-riot legislation, which won the support of the two law enforcement associations. Adam Mason, State Policy Organizing Director for the Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement Action Fund, told reporters that the Iowa bill reflects the overrepresentation of police interest in the state legislature. "We absolutely believe in having a citizen legislature," Mason said, "but that also means we need to have a diversity of opinions. That would mean having legislators from all walks of life. It seems these legislators feel like they don't have to listen to community members because they are coming from concerted backgrounds in law enforcement." Bishop disagreed. "There is no more conflict of interest than a doctor selected to the legislature proposing medical legislation," he told reporters. A major reason why anti-riot bills are controversial are their provisions, which specifically grant civil and criminal immunity to drivers attempting to flee riots, especially given the violent counterattacks social justice protesters have seen in recent years. In 2017, during the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, an alleged white supremacist rammed his car into a throng of counter-protesters, killing a woman named Heather Heyer and injuring 19 others. The driver was later convicted of first-degree murder. More recently, in February of this year, an admitted Klansman drove his truck into a group of peaceful protesters near Richmond, Virginia, though nobody was seriously injured. Last year, NPR reported that there have been at least 50 vehicle ramming incidents since protests against police violence erupted nationwide in late May, a marked increase from prior years. Gibson told reporters that the uptick in vehicle-related violence against protesters is precisely what makes the recent surge in anti-riot bills so concerning. "You can't be a politician and not be aware that there is an undercurrent of informal vigilant justice," he explained. "Where the police are emboldening white supremacists to take things into their own hands. Most of the driver immunity provisions are predicated on two conditions: that the driver was fleeing a riot in order to protect themselves, and that they exercise due care in the course of colliding with demonstrators. But the reality in court might not be so straightforward." Sergeant Fred Lepley, senior director of the Iowa State Police Association, which supported SF 342, told reporters that incidents in which protesters threaten drivers are often difficult to comprehend without proper context. Lepley said that provisions are designed to assist citizens that are attempting to remove themselves from a dangerous situation but find that protesters are purposely forcing their hand by standing in front of the vehicle, refusing to let them leave, and possibly attempting to get at the driver to do harm. In many of these cases, the driver is driving very slow and the protesters intentionally get in front of the vehicle, placing themselves in harm's way. Oklahoma Representative Justin Humphrey, a Republican who sponsored HB 1674, which also contains a driver immunity provision, echoed Lepley, saying by email that this bill is about protecting the public and that it enables a person to protect their family and themselves from criminals who demonstrate intent to commit harm, unquote. Reporters could not find evidence that recent demonstrators have deliberately impeded traffic in an effort to provoke or harm drivers. Other U.S. states where police organizations have actively supported anti-riot bills include Tennessee, Texas, Washington, Ohio, Missouri, Kentucky, Indiana, Idaho, Connecticut, Arkansas, and Arizona. Though most of these bills have surfaced within the last couple of years, Gibson told reporters that the Republican sense of urgency for their implementation has no logical or historical basis. Rioting was already a dangerous, illegal type of behavior, he said, but people still did it. These politicians are deluging themselves if they think that making rioting extra illegal is going to change anything. They are trying to throw peaceful protesters in jail because that is more of a thorn in their side than the riots are.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
Islamati, Allah my Lord,
His word Quran,
His word Quran,
Muhammad,
Muhammad,
praise be upon
him. I am Muslim for all of time.
In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Youth Station on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jabbar. And my brother
Habib.
Yes. Here in the studio, yes, sitting with me again,
yes,
and making me delighted.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice, you know, because sometimes people don't like my existence with them because, you know, I sometimes get annoying and under their skin.
Oh, but, come on.
Yeah, but I'm a fun guy, as you say.
I would tell them, get out of my face. What a lovely person to be with.
Thank you. Now, this is the best way to start off a show.
Brother Habib, you know, there's this mentality among a lot of people, all right? Even when you look at the movie Muhammad by Mustafa Akkad, you know, you've seen that when the Holy Prophet, you know, starts preaching about his own religion, the first people to come embrace Islam were like the slaves and
Mustafa'afin, you could call them.
Yeah, the stooped and the weak of the society, the poor crust of the society in that time. Of course, I'm not talking about like Lady Khadija and Imam Ali as the first woman and the first man, you know, coming to believe the Holy Prophet of Islam and embrace Islam like very hard. And that's a different story. Mm. But I'm talking about the whole like generation and people. All right. So why is it that, you know, when a religion comes, all right, or when you look at religion, all religions of the world are like this, Islam being like one of its like prime example, that mostly the poor become very much more religious than the rich? Is there something like in the money, in the wealth, in the riches, which is against the religion? Or the poor have a better capacity to embrace religion?
First of all, I just want to say this, that the people at the time of the Prophet, this should be studied more, but this is about my, you know, this is just like a quick analysis that I had throughout my readings.
Yeah.
And I reached to this point that the people who entered Islam, who were poor or who were the weak, saw something in the ideology of Islam other than the figure of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi. You know, the figure of the Prophet was also played a huge role, a significant role. But there's this also role for the ideology of Islam that it had. Whether you were black and the white, whether you were Arab and a non-Arab, whether you were poor and rich, whether you were a slave or not a slave, even more, it had its rules are open to, you know, freeing slaves,
mm-hmm.
taking up people out of, you know, being slaved. To this day, we have no slaves. The first, you know, land on earth to lose all its slaves without law, you know, causing it at one manner, like how it happened in the States,
mm-hmm.
was, you know, the Islamic States. They lost all of them because of the way that, for example, Islam endorses al-kafarat, you know, where you have to pay your taxes by setting slaves free. Or it's very recommended that you have to even say, have intention that you are coming closer to Allah with this action to free slaves. They saw that there is no difference between the top class and the lower class in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They would all sit in Hajj, poor and rich, as one. They would all live as one. They would all live in one manner. This is the same thing that happened with the Persians when they converted to Islam. They would, Persians before the era, before Islam or during Islam era, the lower class would never even see the guards of the king.
Mm-hmm.
They would find it, now they are living between Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam. They're seeing Amir al-Mu'mineen sit down, talk to them like a normal human being. This is the ruler of Islam. He's sitting and talking to what they used to call themselves as peasants. There's no such things as peasants
today
in the Islamic ideology.
All right.
That's something very important to keep in mind, that when Islam has this figure and it's correctly being implanted or, you know, placed, and the examples are true and core and based, then what's going to happen? They see this ideology. And now this, to this day, a lot of people are poor, whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
Our reality is that we are under the poverty line. Renting houses in some countries, I'm going to say right out there in the United States, people with the minimum wages cannot rent houses in even the cheapest of states.
So what do?
They loan, they have to take an extra job. Instead of working for like 8 hours a day, they work 13 hours a day. They work 16 hours a day just to get housing. And, you know, it's very difficult. The loans, the payments that they have on their heads, the stress that they are living through. If these people, I'm tell you this, my word is here and it's hopefully being recorded.
Yeah.
We're going to live this moment. We're going to cry out for a savior. This savior is going to bring in an ideology that's going to break that line between poverty and the super wealthy, where people go to space to have fun.
Yeah.
They go to space and spend billions and millions just to have fun.
Yes.
Where other people are struggling just to pay their rent, their basic supplies. People in Lebanon are struggling to even provide water to bathe. There are rivers in Lebanon, and they are struggling to bathe.
So much for Karl Marx talking about the class struggle.
That's the thing. And we're going to see this. It's going to be even more. It's going to deepen even more. We're going to call out.
Yeah.
So it's very important to keep in mind. No. the poor people are, have no, it's not about being more poor or being the poor have more capacity to accept Islam. It's because these people were living in a need. They saw that their need could be fulfilled with this ideology. So they followed that ideology. And they knew and understood that this ideology was not man-made, because man has desires, man has lust. Man does not have equality when he rules. This is divine. This is something from out of humans' hands.
I see. Habib, let's take a break, a quick break, and we'll be back talking more about religion and why the poor are more oriented toward religion. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
This is Muhammad Javad, the host of the program, talking with my brother Habib. Brother Habib, you were talking about a serious issue when it came to this question, why are the poor more oriented or inclined toward religion and all religious issues. I remembered something about the ideology when you talked about this is part of the, let's say, the motto that can keep alive this kind of hope in the hearts of the poor, because the poor see a kind of, let's say, hope in themselves with this religion, in light of the religion, in light of what is told to them, they can make a difference in the society and, you know, break this line, as you said, the class struggle between the super rich and the rest of the society, basically. And the rest usually...
We're one of them.
Yeah. Maybe not really that poor, but at least...
We're one of them. Don't worry about it. We're not going to fly to space to have fun, you know?
Yeah, exactly. All right? But I remember something quite interesting, and this is a kind of different look at the whole issue. It's a novel part, you know, something which is might be a little bit different from your attitude toward the issue. You know, Nietzsche's, the German scholar, Nietzsche's talking about, like, he was, first of all, let me tell you something quite interesting about Nietzsche. He was completely... anti-ethicist, like he didn't believe in ethics at all. All right, yet he was in daily practice, he was one of the most ethical person you can find on the whole planet. Once there was this story which is reported about his life, that he took a like an oath of silence, of course not like swearing an oath or something, or taking an oath. He was silent for a couple of days, and his silence included not eating. All right? Not eating, not drinking. He didn't open his mouth, and he only cried and cried. He kept crying for a couple of days just because of looking at a horse rider lashing his horse to make it move. All right? So look at this person who was talking about, like, and his anti-ethical theories, and then his life, like his theory, quite different from his own practice.
Could I ask something?
All right, yeah, why not?
I think we might have misunderstood his meaning, where the unethical thing.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm gonna complete my
actions. You
issue.
Know, they talk about the mentality.
Yeah,
of the person.
I'm not gonna say he was like. Like, what do you call it, anti or social or anti-ethicist, all right? He was one of the most moral people you could find on the planet, as I said. But he believed, by anti-ethic or ethical theories, I meant, he believed that ethics, he didn't talk about religion, though, right? He said ethics is like a kind of... what do you call it? A potty in the hands of the rich, a kind of means, instrument in the hands of the rich to harness the poor. He believed that with ethical laws, the rich could get richer, all right? Dictating to whoever is under them, like the poor people, all right, to like stick to the ethical laws and act according to it.
Like the cultural effect that the rich have on the poor these days.
Yeah, right?
Similar.
And call it something moral. But yet, when it comes to their life, the
hypocrites,
they never believe in anything ethical whatsoever. Mm. All right? Deep in their heart, they don't believe in it. But when it comes to telling other people, they preach all about ethics.
Don't steal. Why?
Don't steal. Don't do. Yeah, exactly. Stealing is something which Bertrand Russell talked about later in his book. That, well, and then he came to believe that, well, stealing is not such a good thing because he was one of those people following Nietzsche, I guess. All right? So this kind of theory or ideology or, let me put it this way, attitude toward like stuff like ethics is something quite something to ponder. All right? Of course, he didn't talk about religion, though, that time. But what he was talking about is only ethics and moral theories and laws, whatever.
Personally, I think that even the Imamate school of thought has this idea that there are things that human beings, when they are left alone, when they are left alone, them and their emotions, they understand that this is a wrong thing to do, such as lying for no reason, or tyranny, for example. If you see someone hitting, non-religious person, if you see someone hitting a child for no reason at all, and you know it's for no reason at all, the only reason he is doing because he hates him. You, yourself, you don't have to be a religious person. You have to be a person with, you know, high intellect. When you see this, you know it's something wrong. That's something that our ulama, our scholars, always emphasize on. And the fact that there are things that the mind is capable, the intellect is capable of understanding whether it's a good thing to do or not. It's a long debated topic in ilm al-kalam, our theology, and usul al-fiqh, the principles of jurisprudence.
Relying only on this intellect, this kind of aql you talked about, doesn't it lead to a diversity of results?
True. If you have to understand which aql, which intellect is the judge. Because if you take the intellect of the judge...
Because if I go along with my own intellect, I might end up doing something which is quite different from yours.
The thing is that people have, you know, the emotions that attack the intellect. The intellect has to be clear. There are specific rules that our ulama state that makes it possible for them to, you know, say this is good or this is bad.
Yeah, it's very quite interesting. For those of our audience who wanted to know more, they can refer to lots of articles and books written about these things. Thank you very much, all of you, for listening to the program Youth Station on IRIB English Radio with my brother Habib and I, Muhammad Javad, signing off.
Peace out.
In the limelight.
The United States has the highest infant and maternal mortality rates, the lowest life expectancy at age 60, and the most glaring inequities, according to a new report released recently by the Commonwealth Fund. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading U.S. healthcare system ranks dead last among rich nations. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. The United States has the highest infant and maternal mortality rates, the lowest life expectancy at age 60, and the most glaring inequities, according to a new report released recently by the Commonwealth Fund. Using a range of criteria to evaluate the healthcare systems of 11 countries, the Commonwealth Fund's latest analysis shows that the U.S. once again ranks last on access to care, administrative efficiency, equity, and healthcare outcomes. The lone bright spot for the for-profit U.S. healthcare system, according to the new report, is in a category dubbed care process, which includes measures of preventive care, safe care, coordinated care, and engagement and patient preferences. There is no question, our cruel for-profit healthcare system is broken, said Representative Pramila Jayapal, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and lead House sponsor of the Medical Care for All Act of 2021, in response to the report. Jayapal added, "It's time to fix it. It's time to guarantee health care as a human right. It's time for Medicare for all." In 2019, the U.S. spent 16.8% of its GDP on healthcare, 5.5 percentage points more than the next country on the list. By contrast, Norway, which has the top performing system according to the Commonwealth Fund's metrics, spent just 10.5% of its GDP on healthcare that same year. Despite key high spending fueled by several factors, including exorbitant prices for prescription drugs and medical services, the United States ranked last in 9 of the Commonwealth Fund's 10 outcome measures, including preventable mortality, that is about 177 deaths per 100,000 population, life expectancy at age 60, that is 23.1 years, and infant mortality, 5.7 deaths per 1,000 live birth. The United States maternal mortality rate, 17.4 deaths per 100,000 live birth, is more than 2 times higher than France's, that is 7.6 deaths per 100,000 live births. One potential cause of poor health care outcomes in the U.S., the report notes, are deep inequities in access to the expensive system, which is in large part dominated by major private insurance companies and for-profit hospital systems. According to the Commonwealth Fund, the United States consistently demonstrated the largest disparities between income groups when it came to obtaining healthcare services. Due to inability to afford the cost, low-income people in the U.S. were far more likely to report skipping treatments and doctor visits than low-income residents of other rich nations. The U.S. disparities are especially large when looking at financial barriers to accessing medical and dental care, medical bill burdens, difficulty obtaining after-hours care, and use of web portals to facilitate patient engagement, the report reads, adding, "The U.S. healthcare system delivers too little of the care that's most needed, and often delivers it too late, especially for people with complex chronic illness, mental health problems, or substance use disorders, many of whom have faced a lifetime of inequitable access to care. The high U.S. death toll during the COVID-19 pandemic," the report continues, "illustrates the difficulty of achieving good healthcare outcomes if the population is sicker and access to preventive and primary care is limited, particularly because of affordability barriers. The Commonwealth Fund spotlights four features of high-performing healthcare systems that allow them to deliver far superior care for less cost than the fragmented U.S. system. They provide for universal coverage and remove cost barriers. They invest in primary care systems to ensure that high-value services are equitably available in all communities to all people. They reduce administrative burdens that divert time, efforts, and spending from health improvement efforts, and they invest in social services, especially for children and working-age adults. In a series of tweets calling attention to the new analysis, Physicians for a National Health Program argued there are many issues plaguing the U.S. healthcare system, but single-payer Medicare for All would address some of most pressing problems by establishing no-cost access to care for all Americans, bolstering primary care, and drastically reducing administrative costs. Ultimately, the group wrote, lives are at a stake in the U.S.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Imam Khomeini guided the Iranian nation to determine their own fate. June 4th, 2021. A televised speech delivered on June 4th, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the 32nd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini. Greetings be upon him. Whenever we involved the people and whenever we made Islam the standard and the main criterion, we moved forward. However, whenever one of these two pillars became shaky, we screeched to a halt. For instance, we should bring the people to the arena of economic matters. I have been repeating for many years that small and middle-sized industrial centers should be developed and expanded. This is due to the fact that these small and middle-sized centers feed millions of people. Millions of people depend on them. This is synonymous with popular presence. If we had strengthened these centers, we would be in a better economic situation now. The same is true of various other matters. If it really becomes common for the honorable officials of the country to both pay attention to Islamic matters, in other words, to observe Islamic rules in their entirety, whether on domestic, foreign, economic, cultural, political, and various other matters, and also to ensure the people's participation, meaning that they should prepare the ground for the people to show their presence and express their demands, all the problems of the country will be resolved. The kind of Islam that Imam wanted. Well, this was the main issue. Imam's statements are important in this respect. He has made astonishing comments. I have written down a short sentence from among his statements. Imam has clear, firm, and solid statements both about Islam and about democracy. As for Islam, he decisively rejected reactionary and eclectic Islam. On the one hand, he rejected the reactionaries, and on the other hand, he rejected the eclecticists, those who feed their audience and society with the ideas put forward by others, doing so in the name of Islam. Imam decisively rejected them.
Palestinian groups in the Gaza Strip hailed the Hezbollah's move to fire a parade of rockets toward the Israeli regime in response to Thursday Israeli air raids on South Lebanon. Palestinians welcomed the move, describing it as a strong message to Israel.
The Lebanese rockets foiled Israeli plans and projects aimed at separating the resistance in the region. It proved that the resistance won't remain silent in the face of the Israeli crimes. The Lebanese response is a message that Israel cannot impose its policies in the region, and the resistance will keep defending its rights.
The Israeli military said its Iron Dome system intercepted 10 of 19 rockets on Friday, with six falling in open areas in a third day of tension across the borders. There have been no reports of casualties or serious damage. Palestinian groups expressed their support to all forms of resistance against Israel and announced their readiness to stand with the resistance movement in Lebanon in defending their rights.
We hail the response of the resistance in Lebanon against Israeli airstrikes.
This Lebanese move emphasizes the importance of the resistance in defending its rights and foiling the Israeli policies. The Israeli regime is also still practicing all forms of violence against the Islamic and Arab nations, and the resistance is the only way to put an end to these crimes.
The resistance said it won't allow the Israeli regime to impose new policies in the region and that Israel won't go unpunished for its crimes.
We really welcome the Lebanese move to respond to the Israeli airstrikes in South Lebanon and fire rockets at the occupied territories. We stress that we are all united in resistance to liberating Palestine and getting the Israeli occupation away from the region. We are supporting our brothers in Lebanon, and we are all ready to defend any Israeli aggression against Lebanon.
Palestinian factions here welcome the Lebanese response against the Israeli attacks, stressing on fully supporting the resistance in Lebanon against the Israeli aggression with all means. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah says it has fired dozens of rockets near positions of Israeli occupation forces in the Shabah farms. Hezbollah added that the latest round of rocket fire came in response to the Israeli air raids that hit South Lebanon on Thursday. In an interview with a local agency, Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qasim stressed that the resistance is much more capable than it was in 2006, yet downplayed the possibility of an all-out war.
In this phase, the resistance is in an extremely high state of readiness, and it cannot even be compared to the level of capability and alertness which was present in 2006. Whether in the arms, preciseness, military planning, training, preparation, and capabilities. And Israel knows this. So if they launch a foolish aggression under any pretext, Hezbollah will be ready.
An Israeli military spokesman stressed that Israel does not wish to escalate to a full war, but is prepared for it. Experts believe Israel was trying to move escalation towards the inside of Lebanon, but the resistance took things back to square one.
The Israelis have been trying for a while to change the rules of engagement with Lebanon, but Hezbollah's resistance has proven today that the Israelis cannot change the status quo as long as there is a resistance which is ready to face the Israeli aggressions. This was not only retaliation to the latest round of Israeli shelling, it was also a warning and a response to all the violations committed by the Israelis, whether in the air, land, or sea.
Lebanese President Michel Aoun and Lebanese caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab urged the United Nations interim forces in Lebanon to put pressure on Israel to stop its aggressions against Lebanon's sovereignty. Several statements from Palestinian resistance groups were issued in support of Hezbollah's retaliation, which many see as stressing the full legitimacy of resistance groups to face occupation forces. With no civilian areas targeted from both sides, status quo seems to have remained unchanged. It's the first time the Israelis launched such an attack against Lebanon since the 2006 war, but it's also the first time since then that the Lebanese resistance retaliates with multiple rockets against an Israeli military occupation post. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Following a recent call by the Afghan president on the entire nation to establish a united national front against the Taliban, residents of many cities, including Kabul, have welcomed the call by different moves, such as taking to the streets to chant supportive slogans and joining local armed fronts across the country.
Rural people of Afghanistan widely welcome President Ghani's call for the establishment of a national front against the Taliban. We saw how rural people in Herat and other cities put their unity on show by chanting slogans in support of Afghan military forces. This shows that it is a real national uprising.
The entire nation knows that the Taliban have ruined the infrastructures. They are just after war and violence. So I strongly support Afghan national security and defense forces to stand against Taliban.
Afghan military forces say they are committed to strongly pound terrorists all over Afghanistan, mainly in southern Helmand province, thanks to strong support they are receiving from locals.
A report suggests that the shadow governor of Taliban for Helmand province and a number of top military commanders, plus hundreds of them, have so far been killed in attacks conducted by our forces. We will strongly